and welcome to another episode here at the Damage Report. A Damage Report that I was right on the precipice of introing in a bad mood, and then I saw our guests dance during the intro, and I couldn't be in a bad mood. Dan Evans returns once again. How's it going, Dan?
Always great to be with you, John. You know, regardless of the mood I'm in, if I can spend my day with you, maybe my patience thins a little bit, but I usually end in a better mood.
Thank you. And by the way, like the 98% of our guests do not dance during the intro, but on back-to-back days, I guess it was 2 days. On Tuesday, Jason Carter vogued to the intro, and then you broke down and danced to the intro. This is some kind of week. I think it's driving us all batty. But anyway, glad to have you here.
Yeah, no.
And also glad, by the way, that we're going to be introing your new recurring segment live on the show in a little bit.
Oh, I'm so glad that came together and the hours of time we took to prepare that.
Exactly. It was a carefully produced one, fully scripted. So everyone is definitely going to enjoy that. Everybody who is here, and I'm assuming it's probably less than usual because right now a lot of people are probably watching the train wreck that is going on live. As Rudy Giuliani has a nervous breakdown while being paid fabulously to do it. Thank you for being here. Please hit the like button. If you haven't already, you can share the stream, let people know that we're live. Technically, notifications are supposed to go out on all the platforms that we are on, but that never actually works. Tech is the best, but thank you to all of you who are already here. And as we go through our very packed hour plus of news, if you send us comments, tweets, super chats, all of that, we will respond live as we go. Before we launch into it, Dan, anything else we need to, that actually reminds me. Tomorrow on the program, one thing we do have to address, tomorrow on the program, Brett Ehrlich is gonna be joining me. And as always, we're gonna be closing out the week by throwing the worst garbagey people in the country in the trash. Every week, our viewers get to choose one of those three people. And the way you can do it right now is by heading to the community tab of our YouTube channel at youtube.com/thedamagereport and voting in our poll for who you think best exemplifies being a garbage person this week. Dan, you're not gonna be here for tomorrow's program, but if you had to nominate a garbage person right now, who would it be?
Oh, there's some people on the list. We have a pretty good long line of garbage people, but I think I'm just gonna tease it by saying the garbage person of the week tastes like chicken.
I wonder, is that a story we're doing later on? Interesting, okay.
Maybe.
Okay, interesting, I like that. At first I didn't get it, but I like it. So by the way, if you're watching this, if you want some of my initial reaction to the Rudy Giuliani press conference, we have a video that's already up on the channel, which you can watch. I was reacting sort of in real time. I will only add to that by saying that this broken down shell of a man who is representing the most comical attempt to overthrow a democracy in the history of mankind is now sweating so profusely on camera that his hair dye is running down the sides of his face, which I think is a fitting follow-up to the Four Seasons Total Landscaping thing of a couple weeks ago. He is a hot mess. He's the man of the year, honestly, if 2020 is the year we're talking about. But anyway, with that, why don't we launch into other news? Yesterday, we talked about the very narrow attempt by a couple of Republicans in Wayne County in Michigan to not count the votes of Detroit, because let's keep it real, they didn't want black people's vote to count because they knew it wasn't gonna go for Donald Trump. Well, another person on that has gone viral now in a video taking down those two individuals and pointing out what their legacy will end up being. Take a look at that.
You talked about not certifying Detroit, even though you acknowledge that Livonia, a city, by the way, I know you know is 95% white, had bigger variances than Detroit, which is 80% black. We understand, and you've now added your name. So I'm not gonna try to change your mind. I just wanna let you know that the Trump stink, the stain of racism that you, William Hartman, and Monica Palmer have just covered yourself in is going to follow you throughout history. Your grandchildren are going to think of you like Bull Connor or George Wallace. Monica Palmer and William Hartman will forever be known in southeastern Michigan as two racists who did something so unprecedented that they disenfranchised hundreds of thousands of black voters in the city of Detroit because they were ordered to. probably, I know, Monica, you think Q told you to do it or some other crazy stuff like that. But just know when you try to sleep tonight that millions of people around the world now on Twitter know the name Monica Palmer and William Hartman as two people completely racist and without an understanding of what integrity means or a shred of human decency. You, the law isn't on your side. History won't be on your side. Your conscience will not be on your side. And Lord knows, when you go to meet your maker, your soul is going to be very, very warm.
Damn. Dan, what do you think?
Yes, like every time I hear this quote, it fills me with so much energy. Like, this is what I think more people would be interested in politics and engaged in politics again if they saw their politicians and their representative officials actually behave like this and defend them in this way. Like, he's going in, and like there's some people who all of a sudden, now that it's looking like Trump is on the way out potentially, these Republicans are returning back to this day of respectability politics where like Matt Gaetz is upset that someone dare brings up his son or whatever in the offices while you have all these horrible things that are going on. Like, just think of the horrors that have happened to the black people of Detroit over the past even 10 years through the recession, through like the lead poisoning that was uncovered by lots of work and journalists and things like that. And to have their vote taken away, the idea that it's gonna be not certified for them, the way that guy said it best, it's going to be a stain on their records in history, and like their grandkids are going to like be kind of disgusted that they're kind of related to this. It's disgusting and it sucks for those grandkids, but like this is so despicable, and I'm glad he really spoke truth to power there.
Yeah, and I mean, it should enrage everyone. It should be a bigger story. It's a big story, but generally the big story is sort of swamped by how much insanity is going on in the Trump legal effort to do this sort of thing with variations in so many different states. But that's on Trump and on Trump's legal team. Those two individuals, William Hartman and Monica Palmer, like, it is rare that individuals, or just two individuals, get to be this diabolically racist. But they were given the opportunity and they chose it. And we'll get into in a little bit sort of why they ended up choosing it. But the base of it is they see this city, which is overwhelmingly non-white, and they think it would be convenient if they didn't count. They don't count for me. It would be great if officially they didn't count either. It's sort of like the definition of institutional racism. It is the structures of our government taking an entire community and saying, you can go F off. You don't count for anything. We're gonna keep the racist in charge. So the great rant, we're gonna try to reach out to the guy. Maybe we can get him. It was something, and I'm sure he's going to be, you know, he's going to be harassed. He's probably going to get death threats because of this. But the insane times that we're in right now, I think, require a strong response, and it's rare we get one as strong as that. And I just wanted to add one thing. I tweeted this out earlier. There was a headline on Town Hall, that like right wing website, and the headline is written by Beth Bauman: Detroit's votes might not count, and that would be a win for the Trump team. That's the headline. It's just totally honest. This city isn't gonna count. We're gonna do the rest of the state. We're gonna certify everything else. We're just gonna do a donut of certified, and then right in that center, we're not gonna have it count. And if it works, oh God, it would really give us a boost as we try to do the same thing to Atlanta and maybe to Philly as well. Weird, the pattern that we're not going to acknowledge there. The whole thing is just so disgusting. So disgusting. But as we hear all the time, America is a post-racial society. We did, after all, elect Barack Obama, Dan.
Right, of course. And his memoirs sold like almost 900,000 copies on his first day. So if that's not the end of racism, I don't know what is. But seriously, it's just absolutely infuriating, the idea that we all have to understand and contextualize. Yeah, as you said, John, there's so much going on with the legal challenges currently that Donald Trump is doing, and most of them are failing miserably, that it's hard to really catch on to everything. But I think what we have to look at this moment as is a really chaotic case study of the lengths at which the Republican Party is willing to go to suppress the black vote, to suppress the vote of people who don't likely vote the way they want them to, instead of going out to actually get voters to support them for their ideals and their policies. Now, Democrats are also not doing a great job of getting those ideals and policies out there. I think they could do a better job, and they have a great opportunity to right now, the best opportunity they've had to in years for sure. But they can't squander it because this is what they're up against. We need to remember that this is what we are always up against. And so we can't hold back.
I agree. And he didn't. Very good job there by that individual. Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about this. So look, for two days now we've been covering the effort to have Wayne County votes in Michigan not count. And there was that back and forth that Trump was so excited about, where it looked like they weren't gonna certify the results for that one county. It led to this amazing tweet that came out just like 18 minutes before they did certify it, from Trump saying, "Wow, Michigan just refused to certify the election results. Having courage is a beautiful thing. The USA stands proud as we try to take the vote away from hundreds of thousands of black people who don't support me." But why? Why did that whole back and forth happen, where originally they were going to, and then they decided they weren't going to, and then they ended up doing it, but now they want to take back their vote afterward? Well, it turns out those two Republican individuals, William Hartman and Monica Palmer, as well as the Democrats on that county board, they were not the only individuals weighing in on this process. After all, the world was watching, the country was watching, but it turns out most importantly, the president of the United States was watching, and he was calling. A person familiar with the matter said Trump reached out to the canvassers, Monica Palmer and William Hartman, on Tuesday evening after the revised vote to express gratitude for their support. Then on Wednesday, Palmer and Hartman signed affidavits saying they believe the county vote should not be certified. So this we had as of very early this morning, the idea that the president had personally called to either, depending on your perspective, put pressure on or support for them attempting to disenfranchise hundreds of thousands of individuals. And it was confirmed by one of those individuals. Monica Palmer said, "I did receive a call from President Trump late Tuesday evening after the meeting. He was checking in to make sure I was safe after hearing the threats and doxing that had occurred." Well, Dan, that sounds like Trump. You know, when his political future is on the line, he's not gonna worry about himself. He's just worried about the safety of the little people.
That's the guy we know, John. That's Donald Trump. And it's why all the little people voted in overwhelming numbers to keep him in office, except they didn't, except like they, in all the cases where like some of the little fraud they found or instances of fraud have just all been found to be fake or Trump cronies who are trying to brush up things that aren't there. But it's, again, it's one of those cases where the behavior of Trump is very unsurprising at this point. We know exactly how he's going to behave and act. He's going to behave and act in a way that is very self-centered and out to get whatever sort of angle he can to win and victory and look strong, even though throughout the whole process he's writhing around like a fish out of water, just like completely weak. And so this side kind of like calling in from the Don, all puns intended, at the top, trying to say, okay, here's, can you do me one last little favor? It'll be great, it'll be wonderful, fantastic. It's kind of shameless. It's sad that, again, we get to see this kind of politics out in the open and see this what it is, which is a blatant attempt at voter suppression to affect people of color. And I am now moving on towards the step, which I don't think a lot of Democrats are talking about right now, of where's the accountability going to come? At what point are we going to say, oh, we don't want to cause divisions in the country by looking at the past record of 4 years and seeing what norms were broken and what laws were broken and holding any of these people accountable? I'm not saying they go to jail, but like something to at least acknowledge that you can't just openly get away with this. Or are you just gonna say, create the precedent where if you get 4 years of utter destruction and chaos in the country where you bring the entire United States to its brink, you get a pass because we don't want it to get worse. We have a chance to set that precedent right now, and we're kind of looking and gawking at what's going on. But at what point are we going to actually make a decision on whether or not we signal to people in the future that this is allowable, that this is something the United States as a country with so-called laws that conservatives love to parrot and defend and say are just and good in the way we should run society. Do those laws actually work to defend the country, or do they work to just defend capital?
I think you're 100% right. I worry that we already know what Biden thinks about this, according to reporting from earlier this week. I think you're 100% right. The only tweak I would give to what you said from my point of view is I would say continue the precedent rather than establish, because of course Barack Obama was looking forward, not looking back. And I mean, if you look back over the past, you know, 3 or 4 decades of American politics, how has ignoring the criminality of Republican presidencies worked for us? We had 8 years of Reagan. Reagan broke the law, started wars, gave away trillions of dollars, all of that. Then we had a Democrat for a bit. You know, George H.W. was this sort of like a weird aberration. Then we had a Democrat for a while. And then we got George W. Bush, which was like, Dan was 5, so he doesn't remember those years, but it was madness. And a lot of us who sort of became politically awakened and politically active and radicalized during that time were very worried that that was going to be the end of democracy. But thankfully, like Obama suddenly came in, and we had 8 years of Obama, but he was looking forward, he wasn't looking back. And then we had Donald Trump, and look what he has accomplished in just 4 years. Who is looking to 4 or 8 years in the future? Maybe we have Biden, maybe Kamala gets a term or something like that, and thinks the next Republican will be rational. Who's thinking that? But we have this precedent of we're looking forward, we're not looking back. And I would say we're not looking back at the dagger pressed against our back, unfortunately. So I definitely agree with you. And I would just say, in terms of this, I don't know if what Donald Trump did in calling these individuals is strictly speaking illegal. I do know that even if it is illegal, he's the president and there are no consequences for breaking the law, at least now, if not in the future. But when you look at this, unprecedented attempts to interfere with the election. No, if you're a right winger watching this, seriously, you won't engage in an intellectually honest fashion with my question, but you do have to think about it. You can't help the reaction you're gonna have. If you found out that Biden had been calling up the board that certifies votes and pressuring them to go one way or the other, would you be okay with that? If it had happened, do you think that your man Tucker Carlson would be like, no, that's just fair game, you get to do that? The candidates get to call up and put pressure on them to invalidate entire cities. Maybe Dallas won't count. You know what? A lot of Republicans in the Dallas area, Dallas County just doesn't count, okay? Biden was pressuring that. It's just fair game. You get to do that if you want. Nobody thinks that. Nobody,
I mean, John,
that.
If we may, we now, I mean, the one great thing about, I guess, us now having the benefit of time is that we can go back and look at how Fox News and a lot of those figures reacted to the Obama election. Remember Acorn? Because I do. I barely remember Acorn. It was this whole deal where like the Democrats were allegedly stocking votes together and doing these shady things with taxpayer money. And we all listened to Project Veritas and decided to, the left like decided to eat some of its own. And some of the down like level losses of not having that kind of organizational support during the Obama administration, I think we're seeing now the consequences of that in some of the barriers to movement building that the left is facing even right now. So yeah, it was a really great thing that was done then. We saw Fox News' reaction then. Now, of course, they're falling in line to Donald Trump because they are, as they have been for the past 5 years now, placing their bets on the future as it's led by this like bloviating wet sack of COVID waiting to happen. Like this is the bet they've made. So we just watch them as they happen, and we can't call out the hypocrisy at this point because the hypocrisy doesn't work. We'll get to that in a moment, but we can at least learn for the future.
Yeah. No, that's a great point and a great image, by the way. Somebody's pointing out in the Twitch that Dallas went for Biden this year. Yeah, okay, I apologize, Dallas. You're good people. I love Texas. You know what I mean, a Republican city if one exists. Louisville, I don't know. Nashville, I don't know.
Insert that video. I don't know if you saw it during the election, but Joe Rogan was watching election coverage with a friend of the show, Kyle Kalinske. And when Texas was called red for Trump, he let out a woo and like a fist pump and everything, but then like held back because he realized he was on camera. No, Texas is awesome though. We're bringing our liberal values to Texas, such as Joe Rogan.
Exactly. Okay, yes. So this thing by Trump, hope this isn't the last we hear of this. You combine that with Lindsey Graham calling up the Georgia Secretary of State, which is actually, that is a crime. You can't pressure a Secretary of State to commit election fraud. So we have identified 2 horrible instances of trying to manipulate this election. It's just not the ones that the Trump team are arguing about in court.
So in this dramatic modern independent media hellscape, there are people seeking to make information more readily accessible and understandable. And then there are people who see the brand new $100,000 Hummer EV and go, hell yeah. For the latter half, Dan from the internet and the Damage Report present a look at these figures and what they're actually doing. Skip, get ready. We're diving into Griff Nation.
Griff Nation.
Okay, we're gonna have to stretch that intro, but yes. That was great. I love it. We're gonna have something more formal next time. But Dan is a connoisseur of right-wing grift. He's been identifying it and trying to stamp it out for a couple of years now. It's something that has bothered me for a long time, almost as much as left-wing grift bothers me. But anyway, we've got a great, tasty example of grift for you. And actually, some people might currently, as we're filming this, be watching this grifter standing behind what's left of Rudy Giuliani during his press conference. This is Jenna Ellis, senior legal advisor to Donald Trump. Now, if you're not familiar with Jenna Ellis, you're a normal, well-adjusted person. Congratulations. But if you spend a lot of time on Twitter, if you're very online, if your name is Ken Klippenstein, you've probably come across tweets like this. Thank you for having the courage to continue to fight for election integrity. We the people are proud of you, Mr. President. So for a long time, Jenna Ellis tweeted things like that. She was one of the many people, a lot of them blonde women, who just tweet nice things at the president and about the president and get like a following based on that. But that is before. Now, she is senior legal advisor to Donald Trump, actually at his big press conferences. But if you go back not all that long, not that many years ago, she had a very different opinion about Donald Trump, it turns out, when he wasn't paying her and when success and an audience and clout on the right wasn't 100% contingent on deference to the dear leader. Back in March of 2016, she put up this post, I believe on Facebook, saying, I could spend a full-time job just responding to the ridiculously illogical, inconsistent, and blatantly stupid arguments supporting Trump. But here's the thing. His supporters don't care about facts or logic. They aren't seeking truth. Trump probably could shoot someone in the middle of New York City and not lose support. And this is the cumulative reason why this nation is in such terrible shape. We don't have truth seekers. We have narcissists. And sometimes it even went beyond that with posts like this talking about how we're in the last days because of people like Donald Trump, people who are lovers of money, boastful, proud, abusive, disobedient, slanderous, unholy. Not lovers of the good, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. Trump identified by her in 2015 as a lover of pleasure, not a lover of God. When he said he wasn't gonna be in one of the debates, she said, call his bluff. The debate would be better without him anyway. She said he can't handle criticism. This is insanely dangerous to the fundamental American value and inalienable right to freedom of speech. She thought that his comments about women were disgusting, and she was 100% right about that. Now, all of that was a few years ago before the Republican Party was consumed entirely by Trumpism and thus the shift. We're gonna get to her explanation in a second, but Dan, so far, what do you think about Jenna Ellis?
So there are a number of different kinds of grifters out there. You have the kind who's been a Republican all along and they decide to just like go wherever the wind blows and they land wherever the Republican Party is. And that's a savvy political move, sure. You have the brand of never Trumpers or like sometimes Trumpers like Ben Shapiro, who can be quoted in a since scrubbed off the internet, but of course available on archives quote that goes something along like, if Republicans don't say no to Trump now, America will fall into like demagogic absurdity. Meanwhile, he spends every day, probably as we're recording this, basically running laps for that demagogic absurdity. You have that brand of grifter, but then you have, of course, the favorite, the why I left the left brand of grifter, let's say, who has this long history of being against, very strongly against, all of the things that are logical to be against Donald Trump. We mentioned the sexism, we mentioned the inconsistency and the hypocrisy between the understanding of religion and tying to Christianity with Donald Trump's behavior. You see all of that, but then all of a sudden you get a pivot, and that pivot usually comes with money. And it happens so often that it's almost like played out. And the thing that is actually kind of sickening to me, besides the fact that she is getting some benefit out of this, like financially, is that Jenna, she looks like one of these, she seems like one of these, what would be called now as sensational triggered libs, saying this is the end times. Donald Trump could shoot someone in New York and get away with it. 250,000 minimum Americans are dead of COVID, and Trump is nowhere near any sort of accountability for that. And you're working for him now. And you thought that he was gonna bring out the end times like 5 years ago. So not only did you think that he was gonna bring about the end times, you decided to join team end times. And so that along with being a grifter makes you kind of a despicable person.
Yeah. Yeah, you join team end times because it turns out team end times has deep pockets and is supported by a base of people who don't necessarily have deep pockets, but will give whatever they find in their pockets. And this is what you see. The huge shifts when you perceive an audience and a way to cash in, the fundamental element of grift. There's other related things, the victim complex and all of that. But she was very clear about what Trump represented. And the thing is, she was accurate about all of those criticisms. There were Republicans who hated Trump, but weren't necessarily willing to criticize his worst elements because they, still being conservatives, are okay with some of that. They just would prefer that Ted Cruz is the president rather than Trump, that sort of thing. She correctly identified much of the problems with him, but now she's being paid. I don't know how much, but senior legal aid, probably a good amount. I mean, Rudy's making $20,000 a day, apparently. But that's what, Dan?
Can I just say one last thing? Because Donald Trump, we knew this from the beginning. He's the I need loyalty, I expect loyalty person. Well, he's whittled down his administration to so few people that loyalty is now fleeting. Because these things are very easy to pull up. If there are any sort of like opposition research or like vetting that happened in the Trump administration, these things would have pulled up pretty easily. But apparently her ability to be loyal now in this point trumps literally the past like record of things she said against Trump that seemed very disloyal. So it just kind of goes to show where the Trump administration is at a point where they're like looking for people to work with very quickly and desperately. But yeah, it kind of just goes to show the level of desperation they're willing to go to. Yeah. And it's fun to watch. We're not so morbid. Again, 250,000 people are dead, but yeah, there's that.
We're gonna return to in a second. So what does she have to say about this big change? I mean, they all in the end, they have to explain it. Kayleigh McEnany with her comments before. Lindsey Graham was even more critical, I think, at one point, which seems crazy now, than Jenna Ellis was. And he's the biggest bootlicker in the entire country. But she said, I am glad to have learned that I was completely wrong about Trump back then. And I've said that over and over publicly as I saw him keeping his promises and then eventually getting to know him personally. I appreciate K-File showing clearly through past statements that I think for myself and that my mind was changed based on fact and personal knowledge, which is amazing. I don't think that's what it showed. And I think you know that's not what it showed, but it would be convenient if that was the case. It would be a better cover for grift. But she doubles down saying, President Trump is a sincere Christian, the best president in modern history. And thus the circle of grift is completed. You've gone from over the top criticisms to now he's the best thing ever. I'd kill my family if he wants me to. Would you like that, Trumpy?
And 2 + 2 = 5. It's shameless. Again, it's I'm glad we do this service here to show bit by bit that these people are just opportunists and they don't have any real ideology. So that helps us with that knowledge, helps us know how to defeat them ultimately.
Exactly. Yeah, I pray I live long enough to have the opportunity to flip on a person like this, but I always try to think, am I being hypocritical? Is there a case where I had this big of a shift from hating someone to supporting them politically because it was in my benefit? But I can't think of it. Like, if I'm stumping for Joe Manchin in 2024, point this video out, but I don't think it's gonna happen.
I would argue one last point really fast about like hypocrisy, because I think a reflection on like a lot of what even media has done in the tens is really kind of try to emphasize hypocrisy, especially during the Obama administration and the beginning of the Trump administration when it was so blatant. And it's very clear that part of the new era of politics is this sort of like a post-hypocrisy politics, partially in few like influenced by social media, totally. Partially influenced by Mitch McConnell and his like sort of regime of going against, like moving forward within whatever boundaries or around whatever boundaries of the law exist. Like that is, again, these are the people we're fighting, people who will go to every length and measure to retain power and keep power and entrench their power. So even if they're gone, they're like, you have to clean up everything on the way out. So the hypocrisy argument is like, we're way beyond past that. It's more just about how we further expose these people for how they are and then offer something that's far better at this point. Yeah. At least as a strategy for in media as far as like what I try to do. But we do a great job here, John. So that's just preaching to the choir.
We try. We try. You know what choir's like? Preaching. Anyway, if they hated it, they'd leave. With that, why don't we turn to a great example of someone who already had to do their reckoning, like Jenna Ellis. And we've just forgotten that Kayleigh McEnany was also pretty critical of Trump and had very nice things to say about Joe Biden a few years ago. You know, I'd like to be press secretary. I guess you say what you have to say to get that job. But let's turn now to that. We're now deep into the war on Thanksgiving. Lefties like me and like Dan, we were hoping it was going to be a sneak attack, but unfortunately we got caught. And our plot to destroy Thanksgiving has been discovered. This plot that's under the guise of wanting people to not die by the thousands from COVID. And you know who caught us? It was first to Charlie Kirk, or what's left of him. And also Kayleigh McEnany, who had this to say about the efforts from some Democrats to try to stop your grandma from being killed at Thanksgiving dinner.
Well, but we know all across the country, Kayleigh, cases are spiking, unfortunately. And this is the week before Thanksgiving when families are going to be together. And there are a number of governors who are suggesting, look, you don't need to be in a big group, particularly if people are outside your bubble. What do you think of these suggestions and guidelines some of the governors have given in advance of this, because it is a super contagious disease?
Yeah, I think a lot of the guidelines you're seeing are Orwellian. Let me start by saying the CDC has put out considerations as we prepare to go about Thanksgiving, about socially distancing, wearing masks, doing what you can. And there's a whole list, a page of very good considerations. And in that they say, we're not recommending a certain number of people, but we are giving considerations that you should put in place. And I think that's the American way. The American people know how to protect their health. We've dealt with COVID for many months, but it's Orwellian in a place like Oregon to say, if you gather in numbers more than six, we might come to your house and arrest you and you get 30 days of jail time. That's not the American way. We don't lose our freedom in this country. We make responsible health decisions as individuals.
Right. And Kayleigh.
Okay. We're going to turn to the responsible health decisions. First, though, she used the term Orwellian multiple times, and I didn't identify an example of something Orwellian in that. So I have a very quick, simple question. This is for both Dan and also for the audience. Maybe Brooke on Twitch can start up a poll. Has Kayleigh McEnany, or you know, let's make it a little bit easier. Has anyone on that panel completed even one work by George Orwell? Have they read even one?
Vote now on your phones, folks. Seriously, I want to hear what people have to say about that. But I think that maybe someone in the administration has read Animal Farm, but thought it was like about pardoning turkeys. And so like around Thanksgiving, it's like now part of the attention in the lexicon within the White House or something. None of these people know what they are talking about by Orwellian, because it's really weird for the US government and a spokesperson of the US government, the current administration, lame duck as they are, to be warning about government overreach when you are the federal government and you like do represent that overreach. But like, never mind to be said, the Republicans missed a real opportunity to kind of kill the Democratic Party in the last couple of months of the COVID relief, because if they could have let go to some of their overall ideology, they could have tied the idea of lockdowns, which do help prevent the spread of COVID, with economic relief and say, okay, because we're going to lock down, we're not going to completely leave people out in the cold. We're going to do what some European countries have done, which is create programs that supplement your income or your insurance so that during this time where you have a gap in working, you're covered and everything stays the same. You're not completely left out in the cold. Maybe PPP loans that weren't complete scams, that could have been an option to do. But no, they opted for greed. And now you're in the situation where people, even at their best faith possible, and I'm talking about regular American people, now hate lockdowns chiefly because they worry about the economic impacts. And yeah, if Joe Biden can maybe use this opportunity to say, we're gonna do lockdowns, but if I had things my way, if someone at the GSA would sign some damn paperwork, then we would also tie this to some economic stimulus to make sure the brunt of having to lock down and close your businesses during a very lucrative holiday season is at least stifled a little bit, because we have a disease that has killed 250,000 Americans in the past, yeah, like 6 or 7 months. So yeah, priorities, I don't know, economics, it's complicated, what do I know, whatever. But George Orwell though, this is Orwellian, yeah, that's the deal.
Well, yeah, and you don't necessarily have to know what actual critique of modern government, the use of language George Orwell was making, if you can feel fairly assured that 99% of the people watching that program also don't know what it is, but they know it's bad. They know that much. Then to the point of the American people know how to protect themselves. Some do, yeah. Yeah, some people have gotten the information. Some people have regrettably been left behind by the education system as a general thing. And then later on top of that, they've suffered for more than half a year of misinformation about the pandemic, up to and including the video clip that we just played. They might have known and they might have protected themselves if all of the people they trusted in media hadn't kept telling them that it was a big hoax, that it didn't actually matter, that they should go and have big Thanksgiving gatherings. They're still being manipulated and we shouldn't be surprised. The Trump administration didn't care to stop people from the death toll from continuing to go up back when his reelection hypothetically was being affected by the death toll. Now that he's lost, what are they gonna start being responsible now? And so this is what you get. You get someone like the representative of the president saying, you know what, you decide. You just decide, don't worry about your state government, your local government. You're not gonna have to worry about the federal government because they ain't doing anything. You just do what you wanna do. And as of right now, the poll that we have a very reasonable Twitch audience, by the way. 3% say they've read several, either several people on the panel or one person has read several of those books. I think it was about 21% said yes, one of them is completed, and over 70% were like no. They're actually not bad. You know, if you've suffered through Ayn Rand, you can get through most of Orwell in the time it takes to read The Fountainhead.
Yeah,
and
folks, like Orwell is very sort of like, maybe this is like educational elitist speaking. It's like is something you should read, but should not be like the basis of all you understand of political knowledge, because there are some things that Orwell was a little like weird about too. But like with anything, just broaden your perspectives. Read some Orwell. Read some other like actual political thinkers. Just broaden reach. Absolutely. Dennis Prager, I believe, has a really good documentary coming out soon that should be very informative. But yeah,
Does he run a university? I think he runs a university. Anyway, that's Orwellian. Prager, you Orwellian since whenever. But let's turn to, do the people know how to protect themselves? Are they being protected? Let's talk a little bit about how bad things have become. Throughout this week, we've been tracking the numbers for COVID throughout America, because remember, we were told two things over the past few months. One group of people, I'll call them scientists, were saying that we are going to have a dark winter. It is going to be dark times. The numbers are gonna go up, partially because it's gonna be cold. People are going to be clustering more together. You have the interaction with the actual flus, which COVID is not like, but the flu also still exists and all of that. Then you have this other group of people that were telling us, COVID is just gonna go away after the election because it's not really here, it's made up, it's a hoax. You had people like Eric Trump saying that in advance of the election. Right after the election, Dave Rubin said, can we at least now dispense with the hoax of the pandemic? Well, the pandemic isn't ready to dispense with the hoax of the pandemic because the numbers have continued to go up. Most recent daily report from the COVID tracking project shows 164,000 cases and 1,869 deaths. We are damn near close to 2,000 deaths again. The highest death count in one day reported since May 7th. We have gone back, we've shot back before the second wave. We're now back into the first wave of deaths. And when you look at those charts, look at those curves, the cases shooting up, there is every reason to believe that in a couple of weeks that 1,869 is gonna look like good times.
it's the ongoing depressing cycle of 2020 that America really never left its first wave. We just had one kind of big cresting wave that hit us, followed by a continuing onslaught tsunami that is continuing hitting this country. And the way that this is being so grossly mishandled by the Trump administration, again, there should be some sort of accountability here. So we don't say that you can do this willy-nilly with the American government, because then why even bother having an American government? Let's just all renounce our passports today. But there is, because I know people, and I know you know people, John, who like you've lost to COVID and other things like that, or just even like I know people who I haven't like lost to COVID, but like I couldn't go to their funerals or anything because of all this lockdown stuff that's going on. And it's difficult, but because these people are so steadfast in a lot of their beliefs, they are continuing to let this happen, because these are the numbers that we're seeing on a lag, because we don't know the day of numbers all the time. We get some reporting, has to go through some processes, has to be checked and tested, and then these numbers are released. So we're kind of seeing what happened 2 weeks ago when people started getting infected. That was just October. So we're gonna see some numbers from right now around Thanksgiving. And then because the waters are muddied around Thanksgiving and people are going to spend time with each other, that's going to pool into December, and it's going to be very grim. And I'm sorry out there to the folks who are watching, at least who like understand what's going on and have lost or are, might lose people to COVID, because this was easily preventable. And I hope that we, as people who do understand what's going on and can be convinced that wearing a mask is not the same as being under a dictatorship, can call for accountability for this, so that in the next 100 years or 10 years, when a big epidemic strikes, this isn't allowed. We know exactly what not to do, and America doesn't like have this catastrophic sort of collapse like we have right now.
You know, really fast, and we'll return to the serious stuff. But like you've probably seen, everyone's seen the occasional anecdote of like an individual who lived through the, you know, the 1907, 08 plague that just died or something like that. So presumably there are people who are being born now who've lived through this one, who in 75 years, when like Barron Trump's grandkid becomes president, we're gonna have another terrible pandemic. That's what it's looking like. So these numbers are just terrible. I'm glad that you acknowledged the lag time. There's a few doctors who've been writing quite a bit about this in social media. One, Jorge Caballero, said, due to administrative delays in death certificate processing, today's death toll actually reflects persons who died 3 to 6 weeks ago. That means 250,000 US persons died of COVID as of 3 to 6 weeks ago. And if the case numbers are still going up, what is it gonna look like in a few weeks? What is it gonna look like on Thanksgiving? What sort of Christmas present are we gonna have this year if these numbers continue? And if they're given a shot in the arm by the biggest nationwide gathering that we'll have had yet during the pandemic, it's gonna be terrible. And in many parts of the country, it already is. This is dark. Take a look at this chart. They had to add new colors to the COVID exit strategy maps because the highest level, like over, I think it was 25% positivity rate for tests. Too many states all had the same color, so they added more, higher thresholds to differentiate it for 30 and 50% positive on COVID rates. And you can see that band of 50% sort of stretching through the country. The governor of South Dakota, that we talked about on yesterday's show, having the highest COVID positivity rate yet in the country, one of the highest in the entire world right now, gave a press conference about Thanksgiving and mandates and encouraged cities that didn't want to participate in them to not participate in them. Because we all know what we need to do. We get to choose. We love liberty. We love liberty, and we love lots and lots of funerals. That's what we love in America.
If there is one silver lining out of this, John, I know we mentioned that and acknowledged that I was basically a zygote when 9/11 happened, but I have this warm memory of back when American life was dictated in colors, like back when you had the terror alert warning level system and you had all those colors like, oh, Ma, what's the weather like outside? Is it an orange? Is it a red? Are we a yellow today? Oh, that's great. I can go play out with my kids. So now we have like a COVID color chart, and there's even some like nice purples and lavenders in there. So that's another thing I can check in the morning. It's cool.
Yeah, that'll be fun. I mean, what color are they gonna bring in after this? Like they're going pretty dark with those purples. Like, does it suddenly go into a good green or something? I don't know. Something toxic though, I know that.
Ultraviolet.
Okay, ultraviolet perhaps, the flavor of the monster I had a couple days ago. This might be one of the worst stories I have ever covered on this channel. It involves meatpacking plants. So this is a topic that we have returned to multiple times through the course of this pandemic, because it's been very clear from early on when pandemics started to break out in these environments that they didn't seem to care about whether their workers lived or died. And we have unfortunately, tragically found a slight way that they care, but it's perhaps even more sickening than a complete lack of interest. A wrongful death lawsuit tied to COVID-19 infections in a Waterloo pork processing plant that we've talked about, that literal plant before on the show, alleges that during the initial stages of the pandemic, Tyson Foods ordered employees to report for work while supervisors privately wagered money on the number of workers who would be sickened by the deadly virus. There is a lot more, but let's pause on that. So they were forcing their workers to come back, even though many of their workers had already gotten sick. They were spreading it freely inside of the plant. They were forced to work or else they would be fired, and some had already died. And meanwhile, their managers made a game out of it, a game out of how many would get sick, would get maimed, would die.
This is literally Deadpool. I mean, like, not the film, but like, this is the concept of a Deadpool. You're betting on the likelihood of a person or a group of people dying, except those people are the people that you manage, who have families and loved ones who are supplying food for the entire country. And you have decided to treat their lives as so like flies. Like, I'm sure these people take care of their pets, or like would take care of a cat or a stray animal much better than they are doing this right now with regular human lives. It's disgusting, not only that they're doing this, but that the system is set up in which any of these people have that kind of power and have that ability to do so. Again, accountability needs to happen.
Exactly. And like, I don't see how, even without this story, all of what we've previously covered, and you can search the damage report, honestly, search Tyson, search Waterloo, and you'll come up with these stories, how their like entire management team, the owners, the CEO, haven't been dragged off to prison already, but this is even worse. And so I'm just gonna rapid fire go through some of the elements of this, because every portion of it is absolutely disgusting. Earlier this year, the family of the late Isidro Fernandez sued the meatpacking company, alleging Fernandez was exposed to the coronavirus at the Waterloo plant where he worked. The lawsuit alleges Tyson Foods is guilty of a willful and wanton disregard for workplace safety. So if they were, what would that look like? A wanton disregard for workplace safety. Well, Fernandez, who died April 20th, was one of at least five Waterloo plant employees who died of the virus. According to the Black Hawk County Health Department, more than 1,000 workers at the plant, over a third of its workforce, contracted the virus. I would argue that is what a willful and wanton disregard for workplace safety looks like. But that's sort of the beginning, okay? We get hit by the virus, maybe they couldn't see it coming. They totally could, but let's say maybe they couldn't see it coming. What they choose to do after that point, and so far this is stuff we've already talked about, gets even worse. So we're gonna update you. The lawsuit alleges that despite the uncontrolled spread of the virus at the plant, Tyson required its employees to work long hours in cramped conditions without providing the appropriate PPE and without ensuring workplace safety measures were followed. A county sheriff visited the plant and said the working conditions there shook him to his core. And then they have the individual plant manager who apparently got into this cash buy-in betting pool for supervisors to see how many people would get sick. Let's see, we've got John Casey, an upper level manager at the plant, alleged to have explicitly directed supervisors to ignore symptoms of COVID-19, telling them to show up to work even if they were exhibiting symptoms, because it's just the glorified flu, he said. It's not a big deal and everyone is going to get it. Well, that's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy with your attitude. Yes, almost everyone at the plant did get it. Let's see, we have him intercepting sick supervisors who are about to be tested and telling them to go back to work instead of actually testing. They allowed a man to continue working after vomiting on the production line during an international pandemic on the line in a place that produces and ships food. But after all, you can't have a person miss a half day of work after all. They've got people denying the existence of confirmed cases, but I want to jump ahead. because they also had this, which is possibly the greatest intersection of the capitalist profit at all costs motive with the horrible outcomes during this pandemic. Tyson paid out $500 thank you bonuses to employees who turned up for every scheduled shift for 3 months. So think about what that means. You'll get a bonus, so they get to pretend that they're helping their workers. They're workers who, by the way, they're forcing to work or else they will be fired during a pandemic. And if you miss one day, you don't get the $500. So 2 months into that, when you have a fever, what do? You could stay home, you could do the responsible thing, but you desperately need this money and it's contingent on you going in every single day. So Tyson knew exactly what they were doing. And the case toll, the death toll has shot up as a result of that. This is absolutely sickening. I doubt that there will be any legal consequences whatsoever for any of these supervisors, some of whom are being named in the lawsuit. But from top to bottom, the management should be taken out of there. Some of them obviously have legal liability. They should be sent to prison. Others should not be in charge of workers for the rest of their lives. This is absolutely despicable.
Yeah, when you mentioned the point there where you had the worker who was so sick that they vomited on the production line. Remember, this is for food, not like Xbox Ones. This is for food. Like, I hadn't even made a comment here being like the annoying vegetarian about why I'm a vegetarian, but like that fact alone makes the case for one of the reasons I'm a vegetarian. Our meat and food system, and I'm not blaming people who eat meat here, our food system is evil, not just to the animals who like are an afterthought in the story, unfortunately, but they're being tortured and of course like harmed in this entire process. But the people themselves who are working there at this plant across the country. Tyson's not like a random sort of like hole in the wall thing. Like you could buy Tyson frozen foods like everywhere. They're all around the country and like almost every single store. So it's a very big responsibility that I appreciate that they understand they have here as a food distributor. That means you should be taking the sanitation needs during a pandemic even more seriously. And what happened in response to that, Tyson made it clear through the Deadpool of employees, through incentivizing through money. There's no kind of incentive like that. Incentivizing through money for people to work through their sickness in order to get food out of the production line. It shows that they don't care about sanitation. They don't care about cleanliness. They don't care about their food. And so we're hearing about Tyson. I'm sure some of these things are happening in other food places as well. But especially as lockdowns start to commence and you start to, there start to be runs on food, be very careful and cautious about the stuff you put into your body.
Exactly, exactly. And you know, remember this is the most recent disgusting thing that they've been doing. But even in the run up to the pandemic, the Trump administration was letting these meatpacking plants, specifically for pork, increase their line speed, reduce the oversight of supervisors, increase the threshold for how much feces could be in the meat, how much hair, genitals specifically were mentioned. You could have more of that in your meat. This is the same place that had they denied bathroom breaks to their poultry workers, made them wear diapers, according to an Oxfam report a few years back. These are places that were run in an incredibly evil fashion before the pandemic. And what do you know? They stuck to their guns. It's really honestly perfect. Like they are not humans anymore, the management. They are avatars of capitalism that look out on that production plant floor and they don't see animals, they see meat. And they don't see human beings, they see meat. They regrettably still need this human meat to pull levers and advance a line, but they don't feel any more ethical attachment to any of the meat, human or animal in that room. It is absolutely disgusting, absolutely disgusting in every way, morally, ethically, and in terms of the food itself.
100%, John.
Ugh. Okay, let's totally mix things up and go from that to something significantly lighter. Some might say nonsense, but we're gonna talk about it either way. As of just a couple of days ago, Twitter decided that tweets and all of that isn't enough. So they're gonna do what literally every social media site is doing and they added stories. In this case called Fleets, Although with my limited experience with it, it looks and functions seemingly identically like the stories. I don't even know how it's legal. It seems like it's gotta be breaking some sort of law, but they're now out there and not everybody likes it. I think I've been pretty clear in this intro. Even people like Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez says, does the Fleets thing stress anyone else out? Like, I use Twitter to get away from IG stories, not have it follow me around on every platform reminding me that I don't have makeup on. And I, you know, Dan, I know that you're both from the internet and often on the internet. So I wanted your perspective on this. What do you think about Twitter getting in on the story game?
I mean, it's a good time, honestly, for Twitter. I'm going to take a very rare position, John. You might be surprised. And this is going to be called In Defense of Twitter.com. All right. So, like, Twitter is the smallest of these social networks as far as the market cap and all those other things that are important. Facebook is this mega company. Google's so big, it could have 6 social networks that fail and it doesn't matter because the company's still big and YouTube still exists. And so you have all these mega, Microsoft has LinkedIn, etc. Twitter is its own thing. It doesn't really monetize or advertise well. What monetizes and advertises decently? Stories. That's why Snapchat does it. That's why they were kind of like the originals to do it. And that's why Facebook did the Facebook thing and put it in all of their products to where there's WhatsApp stories, there's Instagram stories, there's, I mean, like now we're gonna have Twitter stories. That's a separate, not Facebook platform, but they need to do something to kind of mix it up and make it fresh. Is this gonna be good? No. I'm glad you can't do refleets because that would be only worse. Although for the moment where Rudy Giuliani during the press conference that was happening while we were doing this has the oil from his hair actually running down his face. I would love to see a lot of like refleets or hey, how Twitter go all in and just make us do like flick flocks and make us do like TikToks inside of Twitter. Just let us do that. I would want to see a Rudy Giuliani like drip loop. That'd be great. But yeah, I'm not a fan of it.
Yeah, and look, somebody pointed out on Twitch that stories started on Snapchat, which yes, I guess is true. I never really use Snapchat. You know why? Because it's too much already, everybody. I'm already everywhere. I don't want to do everything. And that's not a new thing. That's been going back to even this. I barely use Instagram. Come on, it's too much. And having to do everything everywhere, why couldn't the different platforms be different? Why couldn't you put your pictures on Instagram? You put out your stupid thoughts about food on Twitter and never the twine shall cross or whatever the expression is. And then on Facebook, you get conspiracy theories from your uncle. That's what these are made for.
Because John, capitalism exists to breed innovation and nothing says innovation, not like flexing on the strengths of your company that are unique, but copying everything else in existence and just doing a game of capitalist chicken. But no, I at least do one thing again in weird defense of Twitter. Instagram added a bunch more like commerce, like shopping things to that. And I'm sure like the fine folks at ShopTYT will make great use of Instagram shopping. But now the app to me feels very cluttered. And that's what I think a lot of people moved off of Facebook and onto Instagram for. The network effect means people are gonna be, it's gonna be harder to get people to move off of another social media service. So Instagram's probably just gonna be like, whereas Facebook's where the boomers are, Instagram's where the millennials are who like never made that leap. And so Twitter continues to be like the Wild West, but it definitely did get a little bit uncool this week.
Yeah, I'm not gonna do it. I mean, I guess maybe I'll have to because Twitter's out of all the social media sites, the one I do the most.
There's pets at least. I've seen a lot of people posting pets and I don't think that's gonna last very long because like anything online, the first day of it's innocent and the second day of it, there's racial slurs. So like you never know exactly where it's gonna go. But I'm seeing a lot of people with pets and there's some of the notorious posters online are doing some interesting things with the medium. So there's that, but just please ignore it. Let's not make stories a thing. Stop making stories a thing.
It's just, it's too much, man. I wanna do the political stuff on Twitter and then generally on Instagram do the non-political stuff, but it is just, it's very difficult and it's too much. And it's like, we don't have to make every single thought we have, every sight we see, everything doesn't need to be made public. And I would argue that if someone like AOC, who's like a master of social media, is reaching the ragged edge of her ability to keep up with this, I think a lot of other people probably are too.
Discord anyway. Stories, Slack stories, Microsoft
Parler stories. I'm gonna call them. Oops, You can do a quick little poop. It'll only last for 24 hours, then it'll go away. And if you do a liberal poop, you will be banned because we care about free speech. So anyway, okay. What were we gonna say?
I think parlay is like a feature in Parler, but like parlay would be a cool thing to call stories there. Cool as in like would bring traffic to an anti, like to a completely racist website, but cool is relative.
Yay. Okay, we only have a few minutes left, so I wanna make sure that we get through those last stories. So let's launch into it. How is everyone feeling in the weeks after the election? Well, it turns out some of them are happy with the result, but not necessarily like in the way that the winner would want. There's a poll we're gonna analyze which shows a third of the country being happy that Donald Trump lost the election, which is slightly more than the one quarter who feel the same about Joe Biden winning. Which is sort of funny when you think about it, that like the people who got the candidate they want are happier about the guy they didn't want's outcome than the guy they did want. Which I suppose, considering how Donald Trump has dominated the discourse for the last few years, isn't necessarily so shocking, but it is sort of weird to focus on for at least a moment, Dan, that we're not that excited about Biden specifically.
It's definitely weird, John, but having had the unique pleasure of going through most of the election cycle and season with you, I think we've kind of seen this idea sort of telegraphed that at this point, the Democratic Party and the Democratic base is not excited about Joe Biden so much as they're excited against the idea of Trump and everything he sort of stands for. And then once you get out of that, you have this sort of vacuum, and where you're getting a lot of discourse is, what does getting rid of Donald Trump mean? Does this mean we're back to brunch and racism is over, or does this mean the struggle continues? And everything sort of breaks down past that. But for as far as where this poll is coming from, yeah, Donald Trump was the bigger motivator, I think, electorally broadly, and I think with moderates as well. It was the biggest motivator against him in the election, as opposed to people being very particularly excited about Joe Biden. I mean, there were 20 other people in the race at a certain point, because everyone kind of knew that there were more exciting options than Joe Biden. It's just that Joe Biden has the political capital and does have some political cachet to be able to get to the point he is right now. And thankfully that worked just barely. But as I said before, as you said on the damage report so like brilliantly, we are going to need in the future, the very near future, as in like before the Georgia runoffs future, some affirmative goals that we can offer people, not just in Georgia, but around the country. And so that we can get people actually excited about the Democratic Party again. So we can actually move further towards building left power and getting people what they want. I'm very much like my last point. I very much like the saying that's going on now that if the Georgia Democrats emphasize raising the minimum wage, that will help them greatly, because it's something you can tangibly offer. Georgia is one of those states where the minimum wage is low, and I believe there are ways you can pay under the federal minimum wage. During COVID, that's a damn no-brainer. So I think that's something they could do. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, not far away off in Florida, that ballot initiative to raise the minimum wage actually passed in a time when the Democrats lost. Maybe ally with the thing that, you know, people actually want. Really fast, attached to this a bit, because you know, it seems sort of fun. It seems sort of weird, I guess, in a political show to really focus on whether people are happy or whatever. But we've been through a very difficult time, like you know, and I don't necessarily focus on mental health and wellness all that much, but I do care about it at least a little bit. I occasionally have talks with Anna Kasparian, who talks about it often, and so it would seem as if. If people are so happy, and you know, you've got like 73% of the Biden voters being happy that Trump lost, that means maybe we're entering into a period where there will be happier. But my question is the relationship between Trump and the country really changing as much as it might seem like it would? From him being president to him not being president, are we going to hear that much less about him? Is he gonna talk less, have less appearances? Is the right-wing media gonna focus less on him? I'm not exactly convinced at this point, Dan. What does your gut say?
I think to some extent, I think it will change and adapt, because Donald Trump had a lot of free media attention from what we consider to be mainstream media sources. Fox News is mainstream media because they get a lot of views and they're available everywhere. So I lump them in, but we've traditionally think of like, ABC News and NBC and all those other outlets, CBS, PBS, NBR, all those as mainstream outlets. And Trump is going to continue to get some coverage in there. It'll probably be significantly less because, like, God willing, he's not the president and he's not in the Oval Office anymore. And so everything else that's around that is just covering the circus. But I think the CEO or like head of the time of programming at CBS at a certain point during the right before Trump won, gave up the cards and said, look, Donald Trump winning is good for ratings. Like, it's good for us here when we are like trying to get numbers up for advertising. And so there will always be that incentive for the media to cut to some elevator shot of Trump at a golf course announcing some new weird scheme. Like, we could absolutely be living in a loop, John. Of course, we absolutely can be living in a loop.
Yeah, that is possible. And I'm sure Rudy Giuliani will be involved in some way. Ugh. Anyway, Dan, as always, thank you so much for taking time out to join us. We miss you here. I mean, right now it's just me, but when more people are here, I'm sure they're gonna miss you in this building. And it's great when you make time out to visit.
Great to be here, John. Shout out to everyone working behind the scenes at TYT. Miss y'all, hope the best for y'all. And also find me, twitter.com/danfromtheweb, youtube.com/danfromtheinternet. That's me. Damage Report's awesome. Awesome. Thank you, John.
Thank you. Thank you. There's quite a bit about the election that we still don't know for sure. The actual results are, for some reason, being disputed to this day. But there are a few things that we do know quite a bit about, and that is how the people, when given the chance, weighed in on the topic of drugs, legalization, decriminalization, and all of that. And joining us now to break down an awesome article about that aspect of this election is politics columnist for Business Insider, Anthony Fisher. Welcome back to the Damage Report.
Thanks. Thanks for having me back.
Glad to have you here. So we did an initial roundup after the election of some of the ballot initiatives and things like that that happened. And it was one of the sort of standout things that marijuana legalization took off, even though it didn't seem like the media was talking about that topic very much. You actually call it sort of like the winner of the election itself.
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of jokes about drugs being the winner of the election, and that's cute and all. But we're the winners of this election because red states and blue states, wherever it was on the ballot, liberalization of drug laws won. Whether it was Oregon completely decriminalizing all drugs, which has been misconstrued as legalization, it's very different. There were several states where full marijuana legalization, recreational legalization was on the ballot, specifically in New Jersey, which is a very big deal and makes marijuana legalization in New York almost an inevitability. And even in states like South Dakota, they voted to decriminalize medical marijuana, or they approved medical marijuana, pardon me. So wherever it was on the ballot, it didn't matter any culture war business, it didn't matter any economics. Everyone said they're tired of the drug war because it's like, much like alcohol prohibition in the 20s, it's a failure. The winners are brutalizing gangs and cartels, and it also empowers the police state. The federal drug apparatus, local cops getting federal money to fight the drug war, and everybody has kind of realized that drugs are still that you can get drugs wherever if you're motivated enough to do so, and the blood, life, treasure, all the people in prison, all the lives ruined, all the children that grow up without fathers, this is the result of the drug war. This is the legacy of the drug war. And so whenever it was available for people to say, I would like to tone this down a bit, they took it.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. I hadn't thought specifically about the impact of New Jersey. We'll go broader in a minute, but you say that it makes the legalization in New York sort of inevitable. In practice, is it going, like, if you're living in New York City, is it going to feel effectively like it's legalized even in the run up to perhaps, in 4 years, maybe it's on the ballot?
Well, first off, it's very unlikely that it'll be on the ballot in New York. We typically, I'm a New Yorker, pretty much a lifelong New Yorker, and we very rarely have these kind of sweeping initiatives on the ballot. But it has been, the state has been fully dominated by the Democratic Party for the last 2 years, the legislature, the governor, and they couldn't get a deal done because, rightfully so, some representatives of heavily black communities, lower income communities, communities that have been disproportionately negatively affected by the drug war. They want guarantees through when marijuana is fully legalized. They want guarantees that their communities will be able to benefit from the profits that are made at the dispensaries. It's an important issue. In my opinion, it shouldn't be the deal breaker that it's been for the last 2 years, because as long as marijuana is in any way criminalized, criminals are going to be the winners of this and people are going to be the losers. So it's not going to be on the ballot. My hope is, especially after COVID, Andrew Cuomo has gone on the record after previously being very, very much against marijuana legalization, saying it's time, it's past time, and we actually should do it to fund the deficits caused by the COVID pandemic. Which seems like a no-brainer, like put fewer people in jail, have cops having fewer bad confrontations with citizenry, and make some money. You know, cultivating and selling a product that is already widely available and widely popular. So in New York, for people who don't understand the geography of lower New York, New York City and New Jersey are so close and share so many transit hubs that they basically are attached to each other. So people that are, you know, working their whole day in New York, going back to New Jersey, they're living under a different law, but it's the same life, it's the same day. So it feels to me like this can't possibly hold. Criminalization in New York can't possibly hold if it's legal a mile across the river.
And so, you know, as you said, this wasn't just a thing of blue states, it was in red states as well. And although, look, I don't pay that much attention on a day-to-day basis to right-wing media, it's possible that they're incensed by all this legalization that's been going on. I honestly haven't seen it. I know our country has been focused on other things over the past few weeks. Does it seem like we've passed some sort of point where you're just gonna, you know, in 4 years, you're gonna have another round of ballot initiatives, and then at that point, effectively, most people live somewhere where it's legal? Or are we thinking that society has shifted so much and the perceived political backlash to federal legalization just isn't really there anymore, that perhaps Biden and the Democrats will actually push for it federally? Which of those paths do you think is more likely, if either?
There's only so much you can do federally. The most important thing that Joe Biden can do, and it's not something that he's indicated he will do, is have his attorney general take marijuana off the list of Schedule I drugs, which are drugs like heroin, drugs that are considered to have no medicinal value and to be the most addictive and destructive. It's absurd that marijuana is on that. And because it's on that, even in states that have fully legal recreational marijuana, where you can go to a dispensary and buy marijuana, they still have to operate cash businesses or use debit cards because banks won't work with them. And credit card companies are banks. So you're creating a dangerous situation where these places that are selling legal recreational marijuana are now loaded with cash. They're a robbery target, and you're also missing out on a whole lot of tax revenue. So that's one thing that I think is possible. Likely, I don't know. Joe Biden's given me no reason to believe he will ever be ahead of the curve on liberalizing drug laws. But I will say this, that on a bipartisan basis, the American public is overwhelmingly for the legalization of marijuana and for the decriminalization of a whole lot of other things. I've seen some socially conservative pushback to specifically Oregon's, pretty revolutionary proposal to decriminalize all drugs. I've seen some backlash to that, but in general, even people who are pretty staunchly on the right, and certainly people who are pro-Trump, feel like it's not anyone's business. It's not the government's business whether or not you smoke marijuana, or whether your neighbor does, whether you imbibe or not. It doesn't affect you. And if anything, most people have probably known somebody whose life was ruined for a petty drug charge. So yeah. I do pass the point of no return as far as states. I think the states, it's just going to be inevitable. It's going to be a domino effect. Federal, like whether it's going to be by an act of Congress, I don't hold out much hope. And I can't even say I'm cautiously optimistic that Joe Biden will take marijuana off of Schedule I, but I'm hopeful.
Interesting. And look, perhaps my last question, you might have already sort of answered it, but just because I don't necessarily follow all the states, has there been any instance where there's been backsliding on this, where it's been either legalized by legislature or by a ballot initiative, whether decriminalized or actually legalized and then they've gone back and restricted it further. Have we seen that in any cases in the US at the state level?
Well, the only case that I could say that's even sort of like that, and it's a loose analogy, would be New Jersey, because New Jersey legalized medical marijuana a very long time ago. But I believe it was right before Chris Christie took office. And when Chris Christie took office, he basically did everything he could to prevent dispensaries from opening. So I think at one point in Christie's second term, I did a story about medical marijuana in New Jersey. And I believe that there were 2 legal medical marijuana dispensaries open in the entire state. They were only open a couple of days a week by appointment. Yeah. Might as well not have existed at all. So there have been instances, and again, now that we're going back almost a decade, where a state backslid on drug law liberalization, but that's the only example I can think of. And think of how far New Jersey has come since then to full legalization.
Exactly. Well, everyone, if you'd like more information about the impact of this election on drug laws nationally, Anthony's article is available at Business Insider called "Americans Have Declared the Drug War Is Over." You should definitely take a look at it. And as always, thank you for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adarola. I'll see you soon.